Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A high-stakes meeting. NATO leaders formally invite Finland and Sweden to join the alliance, while the U.S. and other nations pledge to beef up defenses to counter Russian aggression. Then, investigating the insurrection. A former White House aide's remarkable testimony before the January 6th committee could pose new legal challenges for former President Trump. And a nationwide crisis. A lack of adequate mental health care across the country places a heavy burden on young people in the wake of the pandemic.
Kids are hurting, families are struggling, and our community is having trouble meeting the need.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The NATO summit is underway in Madrid tonight, and alliance leaders have branded Russia as the biggest threat to its peace and security. They also pledged more aid to Ukraine, as Ukrainian President Zelensky appealed via video link for membership.
Russia needs to be isolated. Is it a coincidence that all allies in the East, all our neighbors, are in favor of Ukraine's membership in NATO? No, this is not a coincidence.
We'll take a closer look at the NATO summit after the news summary. Two more people have died in the latest Texas migrant smuggling tragedy. That announcement today raised the toll to 53 fatalities out of 67 people found in a sweltering abandoned truck in San Antonio on Monday. Mexican officials say the truck driver initially pretended to be one of the survivors in a bid to get away. The U.S. Supreme Court today allowed an Army veteran to sue Texas over his claim that burn pits in Iraq cost him his job as a state trooper. Leroy Torres says he was exposed to toxic material that caused lung damage. He says he was unable to work and that the state violated federal law by forcing him out. Also today, the court ruled that Oklahoma may prosecute non-Native Americans for crimes against tribal members on reservations. An earlier decision curbed state authority on tribal lands. The high court's final decisions of this term come tomorrow, and Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement becomes official. Ketanji Brown Jackson will be sworn in immediately to replace Breyer. She will become the first Black woman on the court. A French court has convicted all 20 defendants in the 2015 Paris terror attacks that killed 130 people. The only surviving attacker, Salah Abdeslam, was found guilty of terrorism and murder charges. He got life in prison. One survivor welcomed the end of the trial even before the verdicts today.
It's a relief. It's mostly a relief, both because it means that justice, you know, has made what it had to do, but also because it means that this trial is behind me and I can go on with my life.
13 defendants were convicted of aiding in the plot. Six others were tried in absentia. Most are presumed to be dead. In Israel tonight, Prime Minister Naftali Bennett announced that he will not run in upcoming elections. Bennett led a broad but fragile coalition for just a year before it crumbled. Foreign Minister Yair Lapid will head an interim government before the fall election. That is the fifth since 2019. Back in this country, R&B singing star R. Kelly was sentenced to 30 years in federal prison for sexually abusing young women, including some who were children. He said nothing in court, but tearful accusers told the judge how Kelly had preyed on them. After the sentence was imposed, some of them spoke outside.
There wasn't a day in my life up until this moment that I actually believed that the judicial system would come through for Black and brown girls. I stand here very proud of my judicial system, very proud of my fellow survivors, and very pleased with the outcome.
Allegations against Kelly had circulated since the 1990s. He was convicted last year of racketeering and sex trafficking. There is word that the FBI is now investigating alleged sexual abuse by Catholic priests in New Orleans, going back decades. The Associated Press reports that agents are checking whether priests took children across state lines to molest them. The New Orleans Archdiocese is already in bankruptcy over abuse claims. Tuesday's primary election results were another mixed bag for Trump supporters. In Colorado, far-right Congresswoman Lauren Boebert defeated a mainstream Republican challenger. But GOP voters rejected indicted county clerk Tina Peters in her bid to be the state's chief elections officer. In New York, Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul easily won her primary. She faces Lee Zeldin, a Republican congressman, in November. On Wall Street, stocks struggle to make any headway. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 82 points to close at 31,029. But the Nasdaq edged down just 3 points. The S&P 500 slipped 2. And the last surviving Medal of Honor recipient from World War II has died. In 1945, Herschel Woody Williams single-handedly wiped out a series of Japanese machine guns on Iwo Jima. Williams died today at a Veterans Affairs hospital named for him in West Virginia. He was 98 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, a lack of adequate mental health care across the country places a heavy burden on young people. Democrats push President Biden to take executive action on abortion rights. Climate change forces major lifestyle changes high in the Himalayan mountains, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today in Madrid, NATO's 30 leaders officially invited Finland and Sweden to become members, and they released a new strategic vision that called Russia the alliance's most significant threat. Meanwhile, the U.S. announced that it would deploy thousands of additional troops to Europe. Nick Schifrin reports now from Madrid.
They arrived in Europe as Europe faces war. The leaders of the world's largest military alliance today celebrated what they see as a coalition renewed.
The United States and our allies, we're going to step up. We're stepping up. We're proving that NATO is more needed now than it ever has been.
In a meeting with Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, President Biden announced new U.S. military deployments, including more F-35s to the U.K., more ships to Spain, additional air defenses to Germany and Italy, a brigade combat team of more than 3,000 troops to Romania, and in Poland, for the first time since the Cold War, the U.S. will create a permanent U.S. base in Eastern Europe, the Army 5th Corps Forward Headquarters.
People scoff at having headquarters, but it's the headquarters which allow you to bring in and add things, whether it's U.S. or allies or joint forces.
Ben Hodges is the former commander of U.S. Army Europe. I spoke to him from the summit's media center.
And why is the word permanent so symbolically important?
Well, that tells our allies that we're not leaving. And it also tells the Russians that we're not leaving.
The new U.S. troops in Romania highlight growing concern about Russian inroads in southeastern Europe.
The Black Sea region has been lacking attention for decades. All of the frozen conflicts are in the Black Sea region, from Georgia to Transnistria. Russia has established sort of a new Iron Curtain between NATO and non-NATO countries. Romania is the center of gravity for us in the Black Sea region. It is the place from which we can project power and conduct operations best in the Black Sea region.
Today, leaders have endorsed NATO's new strategic concept.
NATO today also adopted a new long-term strategy. The last strategy in 2010 said we want to see a true strategic partnership between NATO and Russia. The new document calls Russia the most significant and direct threat to allies' security, and for the first time, cites China.
China's coercive policies challenge our interests, security, and values.
I want to particularly thank you for what you did putting together the situation with regard to Finland and Sweden.
On the summit's sidelines, President Biden praised Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for lifting his objection to Finland and Sweden joining NATO. The U.S. says that deal had nothing to do with Turkey's desire to purchase new American F-16 fighter jets. But today, the administration for the first time publicly endorsed Turkey's desire to modernize its jets despite congressional resistance. If Russian President Vladimir Putin is feeling the heat from a reinvigorated NATO, he chose today to rally his own friends, including Iran and three Central Asian former Soviet states. Russia and the West continue to take new confrontational steps. Today, Stoltenberg denied it was a new Cold War, but he vowed in Ukraine, the West would not blink.
Ukraine can count on us for as long as it takes.
Stoltenberg was talking about the message that NATO delivered President Zelensky during a virtual meeting today. The message that Zelensky delivered NATO, he was not happy that Ukraine is still waiting for an official invitation 14 years after NATO first promised it. He told NATO leaders today, quote, NATO's open door policy should not resemble the Kyiv metro turnstiles. They are open, and when you approach, the turnstiles close until you pay. Hasn't Ukraine paid enough? And compared to the years that Ukraine has been waiting, Finland and Sweden are expected to join NATO within a matter of months. Judy.
And Nick, meantime, tell us about the steps that NATO and Turkey took today after this deal that Turkey agreed to let Finland and Sweden join.
Yeah, NATO leaders officially invited Finland and Sweden to join the alliance. That was seen as a formality. But Turkey took a step today, referring to the deal's clause that there were possible extraditions. And Turkish officials today demanded that Sweden and Finland extradite Kurds that Turkey claims are terrorists. Some of them actually are journalists who fled Turkey for fear of their lives. Reporters asked the Finnish president and the Swedish prime minister about Turkey's demands today. And those leaders, frankly, dismissed them, saying that the questions of extradition were up to the courts. And Judy, it's just not clear what Turkey is going to do if its demands continue not to be met.
Will certainly be worth watching what happens there. And Nick, what about the U.S. announcements today? How do they fit in with what we were discussing last night, which is NATO planning to fortify its eastern flank?
Yeah, as we were talking about, NATO will send more troops to the Baltics, from about 1,000 troops, that's a battalion level in each country, to a brigade, more than 3,000 troops. The U.S. will contribute to those additional troops, even as what we talked about tonight, the U.S. base in Poland and the U.S. Brigade combat team in Romania are actually exclusively U.S. forces. Separately, NATO will dramatically increase the number of troops that are on high alert from 40,000 to 300,000. The U.S. will participate in that with pre-assigned American troops staying in the U.S. but able to deploy at a rapid level, and also with pre-assigned equipment on the eastern flank, Judy, that those troops will be able to use if they have to deploy.
And last thing, Nick, tell us how Russia is responding to these announcements today by President Biden about additional troops, U.S. troops in Europe.
Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said today that the U.S. was under the, quote, illusion it would be able to intimidate and restrain Russia. It will not succeed. Of course, Judy, NATO officials say it is Russia that is trying to intimidate and restrain NATO. Eastern European officials have long wanted the U.S. And Western European officials to see Russia's threats as empty. The senior U.S. officials I talked to still fear some kind of escalation. But for now, Judy, they are willing to take steps to bolster European security that they haven't taken in decades.
All right. Nick Schifrin reporting for us from the NATO summit in Madrid. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Yesterday's remarkable testimony from former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson painted an incriminating picture of former President Donald Trump's actions on and leading up to the events of January 6th. Hutchinson's testimony outlined how the former president knew that many in the crowd on January 6th were armed with weapons and wanted the metal detectors, or magnetometers known as mags, to be removed so that more of his supporters could attend his speech. But at that rally, he still encouraged them to, quote, fight like hell and march to the Capitol.
I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
All of this and more raises questions about possible criminal charges and other consequences for the former president and for his inner circle. To help us better understand the legal implications, I'm joined by attorney and former Watergate prosecutor Jill Winebanks. Jill Winebanks, welcome back to the NewsHour. So much emerged from that testimony yesterday. We were listening to a lot of it was not just new, but it was shocking. But how do we distinguish between what's interesting and that it just leaves us hardly believing what we're hearing and what is truly a potential legal violation?
I think her testimony was one series of elements of crime after another. She laid out a lot of things, not just against the former president, but against her boss, Mark Meadows, and many others. Crimes that she spelled out were obstruction of Congress, inciting a riot or insurrection. She also played out a possibility for seditious conspiracy and conspiracy to defraud the U.S. Those are among the crimes that she talked about. We already have state crimes. The Georgia call that the president, former president, made is another crime. But all of her testimony was really relevant to many of the aspects. And the part that you just mentioned about his knowing that his supporters were armed, that they were carrying rifles, AK-47s, Glock pistols, brass knuckles, and that he, knowing that, said, go to the Capitol, fight like hell. You have to do it or we won't have a democracy left. Well, doing it could have endangered a democracy. And he knew that they were violent. And so he is responsible for it. And I think she really laid that out. And she also linked the White House through Mark Meadows to the meeting that was at the Willard Hotel, talking about the fake electors slates and pressuring Pence and pressuring the state legislatures to take action to undo their confirmed votes. So she laid out a lot of crimes and a lot of evidence and was very credible, I think. Some of her testimony is now being maybe challenged, but until they testify under oath, her testimony is the only one under oath. So Secret Service saying there's some dispute about her saying what she heard people who were in the car after his rally speech say is what's being challenged. But they aren't saying it under oath. And until they do, hers is the one that's under oath.
Well, let me, and I do want to ask you about that, but let me take those one at a time. What we heard her say about the president knowing that these people attending the rally, many of them were armed, encouraging them to go to the Capitol, is that in and of itself a violation of law, whether it's obstruction of justice or an attack, as you said, on democracy?
It could be both. It can be an obstruction of Congress because the intent of getting the crowd there was to prevent Congress from taking and opening the ballots and counting them. That's what the Electoral College Act says. That's what the Constitution gives the responsibility to the vice president. His only responsibility is really ceremonial. He's to open the envelopes that the states have confirmed and sent. That's all he does. And then the ballots are counted. The crowd was intended to, and did, of course, actually disrupt it, fortunately, only temporarily, because the vice president did not leave the Capitol, and neither did the members of Congress who were threatened by this violent mob. But they came back and they did their job working late into the night. And it's once it starts, it cannot be adjourned according to the law. So they did the right thing staying. That's very important to keep in mind. So that's one crime. But it is also, of course, a threat to democracy if we don't count the votes as they were cast. And if we turn it back to the states to say, well, I didn't like that vote, so I'm going to appoint a different slate of electors, that would be the end of democracy. That would be an authoritarian dictatorship.
Excuse me, is there any one thing that she said that in and of itself could provide enough information, enough evidence to prove that the law was violated?
Well, I think you have to be realistic and say that one person against another is never going to make a case. But here we have her testimony and many others. We've heard days now of testimony before in public. from the committee where Republicans have come forward saying, this is what I know. This is what I was asked to do. We heard Rusty Bowers from Arizona. We've heard all of these people say things, and the combination makes it what is a crime. I don't know that you can take any one thing that could be rebutted. Certainly his saying, I don't care about them being armed. They're not out to hurt me.
Yes.
That certainly means he knew that they were out to hurt someone, and he just didn't care because it wasn't him. It's always about him. And so I think that's one of the most damaging things that she personally heard him say was, I don't care. I want them here. They can march to the Capitol from here, knowing they were armed. That, to me, is probably a violation of the most important law, which is one that says if you ever are involved in an insurrection, you can never run for office again. If you once having taken an oath to the United States, then engage in an insurrection. And that pretty much would establish it, but not on its own. It takes all of their testimony.
In just a little bit of time we have left, the statement, the hearsay, she overheard the chief of staff saying to Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, that you know the president agrees that the vice president deserves what the crowd is chanting, hang Mike Pence. Could that in any way lead to a criminal charge?
In order to be tried and used in court, it has to either be within an exception to the hearsay rule. You cannot in a trial say, I heard somebody else say that they heard somebody say. But a lot of those do fall within exceptions of statements against interest. And so it might be admissible. It does point to how important getting Mark Meadows to testify is. Mm. He is really a key factor here. And Pat Cipollone, I cannot believe that they haven't been subpoenaed, that they haven't come in to testify. This 25-year-old aide is the one who was advising her boss, don't go to the meeting at the Willard Hotel. That's not a good idea. She was the adult in the room. But it is really important that John Dean's successor, Pat Cipollone, could be the next John Dean. So
well, we know.
Let him move forward.
We know the committee is trying to get those other individuals to testify. Jill Winebanks, we thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Last December, the U.S. Surgeon General issued a rare public advisory warning of a, quote, devastating mental health crisis among American teens. Symptoms of depression and anxiety for children and adolescents have doubled during the COVID-19 pandemic. But special correspondent Kat Wise reports on why accessing mental health treatment is so difficult for so many. And a warning, these next segments include explicit references to suicide.
My name is Chelsea. I'm with Youth Village's Mobile Crisis. I'm just going to ask you some questions, okay? Have you ever tried to hurt yourself?
Any self-harm, like cutting, burning, or scratching?
For counselors at this youth crisis hotline in Knoxville, Tennessee, it's a busy morning during another busy week.
Is he on any medications?
The hotline averages more than 1,000 calls a month.
How often does this behavior occur?
It's run by Youth Villages, a nonprofit founded in 1986 that works with children who have serious emotional, mental, and behavioral health issues in 23 states.
I know Mom called us about some concerns. I just want to make sure that you're okay.
So have the homicidal threats been since all this happened, or was that prior?
Raquel Schutze is the organization's program director for crisis services in Tennessee.
This past fiscal year has been our highest volume on record.
What do you make of that?
Kids are hurting. Their families are struggling, and our community is having trouble meeting the need.
That need, which was already growing prior to the pandemic, is hitting families across the nation. 70% of U.S. counties don't have a child psychiatrist, and more than 60% of youth who report having severe major depression are not receiving any mental health treatment.
I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who to call. When she tried to hurt herself, I took her to the hospital. It was all I knew to do.
Peggy Patrick has been caring for her 16-year-old granddaughter, Jackie, since she was a baby in the rural town of New Tazewell, Tennessee. She says around the age of 12, Jackie started changing from an outgoing and friendly child to withdrawn and often depressed.
I thought hormones, you know, and I even told her that. Guess I tried to convince her that this was a phase.
Was there a moment you can recall when, you know, you thought that we need some help here? This is not, you know, normal.
I do. She started cutting herself. She attempted suicide. And when she would attempt suicide, of course, I'd take her to the hospital.
Jackie's story is unfortunately becoming more common nationwide. Emergency room visits for suspected suicide attempts are up 51% for adolescent girls since 2019, and one in three high school students report having persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness.
Has it been difficult to find mental health help for Jackie?
Good mental health, yes. It's been hard. I had a list of people that I thought would help her. A lot of them was too far away for us. We couldn't get there. A lot of them wouldn't take the insurance. I mean, you're helpless.
Over the last 4 years, the family struggled to find a consistent therapist for Jackie. Most were nearly an hour away by car. And treatment options in the area are limited for teenagers and often can be difficult to access. Jackie told us she once waited a month for a bed to open in a long-term inpatient facility. Nationally, the number of residential treatment facilities for youth has fallen by 30% since 2012.
I am a very bad overthinker. So I'm all the time thinking of worst scenarios that could go wrong and how things might just end badly in any way possible.
Jackie says she's speaking out about her mental health in hopes of helping other teenagers.
I mean, I was always bullied as a kid. I don't have many friends now as it is. I never got invited to do stuff with my friends. You know, even if they did consider me as a friend, I didn't get invited to go hang out that weekend or to go to the pool or to the park or anything like that. So I kind of had like a fear of missing out. And also there was always the stigma of, like, you know, on TikTok and stuff like that, there's the pretty girl image. And I feel like that takes a toll on a lot of people.
Can you tell me about sort of what happened in those days?
Well, it either ended up in me self-harming or me trying to kill myself again. So, and those are very scary times.
How many times did you attempt suicide?
Probably about four.
After her most recent attempt earlier this year, Jackie was connected to a Youth Villages crisis team. She was then placed into what's known as their Intercept program and paired with family intervention specialist Samantha Davis Mize.
I'm going to let you be the driver on this one.
Okay, so for my calming drawer, I think I want to make it my happy place.
Okay, so we've got a happy place.
Yes.
Okay.
Every day, Davis Mize visits families like Jackie's across this sprawling section of East Tennessee.
Meeting Jackie for the first time and coming into the home and just sitting with her, she just looked like she had walked a long journey. She was tired. And she was crying out for, hey, I need some help.
Youth Villages says the Intercept program works with about 11,000 families in more than a dozen states.
I had the psychoeducation on trauma and stress responses with the family.
The goal? To bring mental health services directly to the homes of families who need it most. These services include visits 3 times a week from specialists like Davis Mize and regular consultations with not only at-risk youth, but also parents and guardians.
A lot of parents have never had to deal with this before. This is new.
Sydney Earle is a clinical supervisor for the Intercept program.
We work with a family in their home, right where they're comfortable and identifying the root of whatever the problems may be and figuring out how to collaboratively solve those together.
One of the first steps for families, locking everything up in their homes that could be potentially dangerous.
So this is your lockbox?
Yeah. And this is, you know, everything I need is all down in here. When I need to peel the potatoes or get a pair of scissors or I have to unlock the box, and I have another one over there. It's got some stuff in it. But
this Peggy Patrick admits this initially felt a little bit invasive.
But it's worth it. It's worth it to keep your kids safe.
Let me just get this situated in our system, and then I'll get some information from you, okay? Is he currently safe right now?
Youth Villages funds its crisis hotline through the Tennessee Department of Mental Health. And for many families, like Jackie's, these intensive in-home services are funded through the state's Medicaid program. Today, Jackie says the help has come at a crucial moment, and that her mental health is now in a far better place.
Eventually, I gave myself the opportunity to say I want help. And I feel like I finally opened my eyes and said that I wanted something better for me and I wanted a better life for me.
Jackie says she's also speaking out to help parents and guardians know how to talk to their kids about mental health.
I feel like every parent needs to listen to their kid extensively. I feel like a big question that needs to be asked is, are you really okay? Not, are you doing okay? Or is there anything I can do for you? No, are you really okay? And I think that more parents need to have a sit-down conversation with their kid and make it known that they care and that they're there to listen.
Advice that now seems more urgent than ever. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kat Wise in New Tazewell, Tennessee.
So powerful to listen to that. And let's pick up now on one part of how people can get help. A new national mental health hotline will launch next month. Like 911, the hotline will be available by dialing 3 digits, 988, an equivalent hotline for mental health services. But as Stephanie Tsai reports, some experts are concerned about whether the hotline is ready for prime time.
Judy, the idea behind 988 is to connect people in a mental health crisis to experts trained in how to respond. And while it's an opportunity to get people the help they need, with less than a month to go before its launch, a recent national survey found many agencies at the state and local level don't feel prepared for it. For a closer look at these concerns, I'm joined by Bob Gebbia, CEO of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Bob Gebbia, thank you for joining the NewsHour. This hotline is not explicitly for suicide prevention, but certainly when a person gets to that point, they may need to turn immediately to this kind of resource. What do you hope 988 will do?
We're very excited about the potential that 988 has for bringing attention to this need. It's a big need for crisis response. Many people who struggle are not calling for help. And many, about half of those who die by suicide, are not in any treatment at the time of their death. So this is a way to close that gap. And we want the public to know it's available. So we're very excited about the potential that it has.
But Bob, since 2005, there has been this National Suicide Prevention Lifeline already. How has that been working out, and what kind of challenges has it had in failing to maybe deliver on its promise?
Well, you know, you have to look at it historically, and crisis services have been undervalued and underfunded. So when the Lifeline was set up, it didn't receive anywhere near the kind of funding it needed to meet what has been a dramatic increase in demand since it was set up. So again, this is an opportunity to increase that funding. The thing about it that's really hopeful is two things. One, it's easy to remember, right? So it's the equivalent of 911 for emergency, medical emergencies. And now we have something that people can easily call, easily remember when they're struggling with their mental health. But second, it really provides an opportunity to really invest for the first time in crisis services, not just the call capacity, which has to be invested in or else people will not get their response that they need. But it also allows us to really rethink what happens when there's an in-person response, when someone is in real emergency and needs someone there.
But Bob, let's talk about that call capacity, because that survey I mentioned, the RAND Corporation did a survey last year that found that although the government has allocated around $282 million to strengthen network operations, to strengthen local crisis call capacity, states and locales responded in that survey that they don't feel prepared. So what is the problem there?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to take some time. There is a system and it works. It needs to be improved dramatically, especially as more people learn of 988. We do anticipate an increase in volume, right? But I think the most important thing now is to get those investments. About four states out of all of the states have approved tacking fees onto telecom bills, which the legislation, the federal legislation, allows. About another nine have found other state funding sources and approved those. And about a dozen or so are now looking at legislation. So it's moving, but it's moving far too slowly at the state level. Only half have really invested in. And we think the fees are a great way. It's a few pennies per person on their telecom bills that would go to support and sustain and increase crisis services of the local centers. But our federal government has a role too, and they need to continue to put funding in for building that capacity.
What other concerns might you have? I mean, 988 is supposed to roll out on July 16th. That's less than a month. Yes. What other concerns do you have as they roll this out about capacity? Because the New York Times did an analysis that found that 17% of callers to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline last year actually hung up while they were waiting. Is that a great concern to you at this point as this rolls out?
Wait times should be going down, not going up, and they have been going up. The way the system works, when a caller calls the current lifeline, and that'll soon be 988, what happens is they're routed to the closest crisis center, local crisis center, to their call, where they're calling from. And so when that center doesn't answer, it rolls over to backup centers. We need to make sure while we build out this system that the backup centers have the capacity so that call time, wait time doesn't increase and people don't, you know, calls don't get dropped and people don't hang up because, you know, they can't get the response. The worst thing is when people take that brave step. You know, you're struggling with your mental health. It takes a lot to step forward and to call. And we want to make sure when people call, they get connected, they get help. And the other thing I'm concerned about is to make sure as we invest in the capacity that we also change crisis response. You know, it's been built around law enforcement responding, and law enforcement was never trained or prepared to do this. It was a de facto arrangement. When you call 911, you get a law enforcement response. We need to change that to mobile crisis teams, train mental health professionals, coordination between 911 and 988 in the future so that calls can be transferred to 988 if that's the appropriate response, and to make sure when there is an in-person response, which is the exception, it's not most calls, most can be resolved over the phone, but when it's needed, that it's a trained mental health response and that people also go to respite centers rather than to emergency departments where they can wait for hours and even days without getting any mental health care. That system's not prepared either. So there's a lot resting on this. It can be life-changing and life-saving if it's done properly.
Bob Gebbia, CEO of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Thanks so much for joining the NewsHour, Bob.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
President Biden promised to do everything in his power to protect abortion access after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. In the days since that historic ruling, pressure from Democrats in Congress and from outside advocates has been mounting on the president to take executive action as some states move to restrict and ban the procedure. To help us understand what choices the president has and what comes next, I'm joined now by our White House correspondent, Laura Barrone Lopez. Laura, hello. So you've been spending some time looking at this. We know the president's options are limited. They're not endless. He is getting this pressure from Democrats in Congress, outside advocates. Give us a sense of what they're pushing him to do and what's realistic.
Right. So the president is abroad this week, as we know, Judy, but he's facing so much pressure to act quickly and to act, to get creative about what kind of proposals he could do unilaterally. And so I want to just run through the executive action proposals that the president is being pushed to take and which ones he may not. So the first one is providing abortions on federal property. That's something that the White House has said it's not considering at this point. They really don't want to go that route because a White House official told me today that it could put women and providers at risk of criminal liability, especially if a Republican president comes into power after Biden. The next one, declare a public health emergency. That's something that a number of black congresswomen have been really pushing the president to do. They think that it could free up a lot of resources and improve coordination across from federal to state to private and public health care. The White House has not said either way. Next, expand access on military bases. That's something that General Austin has actually said that they cannot do. There are a lot of limitations with the law right now, and so that's not something that the White House is going to be considering. Increase access to medication abortion. This is a big one, something that could probably impact the most people across the country, and that would require the FDA to pretty much declare that they are going to preempt state laws, that they have the power to do that under the Constitution to provide these abortion pills. It also would require them to drop one of their final restrictions, which makes pharmacies obtain a license to distribute the drug. And then finally, Medicaid funding for interstate travel. What's key here is that it's funding for traveling, not for the procedure itself. And so that would require HHS to direct that ability for people to have that funding if they travel across state lines.
So these are all the things that these different promoters of doing something are talking to the White House about. But you're finding in your reporting, you were telling us, that there's now a growing divide among these groups and advocates about what to push.
So there are a number of progressive lawmakers, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts as well, but they are really pushing the president to get as creative as possible and push the envelope. Now, I spoke to Mini Tiramanju today. She's the president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and she had this to say about the frustrations that we're hearing from a number of Democrats.
I understand the frustration. We share it, but I also think the attention needs to be paid elsewhere. I think there are limitations to what the executive branch can do, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And now that the Supreme Court has banned abortion, has overturned Roe, the fights really are in the states.
So Tiramanju said that she's not necessarily endorsing a cautious approach, but that so far she thinks that the White House is doing what it needs to do in order to get ready for potential executive actions. But I was talking to a number of law professors today who actually advised the White House, and one of them, Lawrence Gostin of Georgetown, said that, yes, the president's heart is in the right place, but that he was surprised that the White House didn't have executive actions or a game plan right off the bat when the decision came down, because everyone had been expecting the Supreme Court to rule this way.
That's interesting. So we know, Laura, at the end of the day, the Supreme Court's rule, the president can't in any way turn this decision around, and he's dealing with a Congress right now because of the numbers in both the House and the Senate, where the votes are just not there to make major changes on abortion. So how much of what the White House is looking at has to do with the midterm elections and seeing what the next Congress looks like?
A White House official told me today that the president is being straight with the American public, that he's just trying to tell the truth about what's realistic and what's not realistic. And when the president addressed the nation right after the Supreme Court decision, this is how he framed it.
We need to restore the protections of Roe as law of the land. We need to elect officials who will do that. This fall, Roe is on the ballot. Personal freedoms are on the ballot.
You heard the president right there say that it's all about the midterm elections. And so the White House is really stressing that point. Every official that you talk to says that ultimately, if voters do not elect more Democrats to the Senate, then reversing what the Supreme Court did is not possible.
And we're hearing the vice president put that message out as well right now. Laura Barrón-López, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Research published last year in the journal Scientific Reports shows the massive Himalayan glaciers have shrunk 10 times faster over the past four decades than during the previous seven centuries. This threatens agriculture and the water supply for millions of people across South Asia. Fred DeSam Lazaro reports on one project that's aimed at blunting the environmental impact, at least for some communities high in the Himalayas. It's part of Fred's series, Agents for Change, and it's produced in partnership with the Pulitzer Center.
It's spring planting time in India's Ladakh region. Tough, rocky terrain plowed by farmers and the beasts they coax forward in song, a cross species between oxen and yaks. This group of families tilling the land are among a dwindling rural population along this 300-mile stretch of the Tibetan Plateau, some 13,000 feet above sea level. All around them are terraced fields that were once cultivated, their neighbors having migrated in recent years to cities in search of work, driven increasingly by unpredictable weather. Water is an ever-present worry, says 42-year-old Jigmet Chozeng.
The water comes from that glacier. It has to be divided among many people. It was not reaching us down here.
This mountainous region is one of the driest places on Earth. Historically, rainfall has averaged just 3 inches per year. People here have depended on water trickling down from mountain glaciers, but in recent decades, those glaciers have been shrinking and weather patterns have become erratic. Many scientists predict that those glaciers could disappear altogether by the end of this century.
We are the first victims at the frontier.
Sonam Wangchuk, a local educator and environmentalist, came up with one solution called ice stupas that provide water in early spring.
Some would call it artificial baby glaciers.
In May, he took me up to see one of these structures, named for their resemblance to the Buddhist monuments that dot the landscape. It's not so much about a shortage of water, he says, it's about controlling when it flows.
There's not enough when you need it. There's too much when you don't. So it's an issue of optimization.
Solid ice.
About 9 years ago, Wangchuk and his students came up with the idea to store water by freezing it during the cold months. Their first challenge, to keep it frozen and slow the pace at which it would normally melt. A problem solved with the conical stupa shape, built on a foundation of brush and branches to help freeze the water more quickly.
These shapes have low surface area, means the sun doesn't get enough surface area to melt it. We're sort of cheating the sun.
So suppose there's a mountain range like we are in.
Wangchuk is an engineer by training, but says this is not rocket science. No pumps, no electric power, just basic physics and geometry.
So upstream somewhere here, you put a pipe and then bring it downstream to where you need. When water enters this pipe, it goes down and wants to go up and up and up to this level. Then it splashes the water in the air, and that way it falls down and freezes.
He says the stupas can reach heights of up to 160 feet and store several million gallons of water. Starting in April and May, it begins to melt, swelling the streams, irrigating farms, and helping green the dry landscape.
After the ice stupa was placed here 3 years ago, everyone gets equal water. It's good for the crops.
Are you living happily ever after in this area in terms of the glaciers disappearing?
Not at all. We consider these very humble, insignificant tweakings compared to what we are going to face.
They are a short-term solution, he says, and the lack of reliable water supply isn't the only problem caused by climate change. Glacial water is being replaced by rain, falling over land that cannot absorb it fast enough, with disastrous consequences.
2006, there was a big flash flood. And I asked a casual elderly man, when did you see last time such a devastating flash flood? He said, I don't remember, not in my lifetime. And you know what? The next one was in 2010, and with much more fierce devastation. The next after that was 2012, 2015, 2017.
The 2010 cloudburst alone brought 14 inches in 2 hours, killing more than 200 people and causing widespread damage.
We need to think of even the eras after glaciers. And to prepare for that, we need to sow the seeds today, and which is what we have gathered here today for.
Wangchuk has helped spearhead an effort to plant indigenous trees to help contain flooding. The implications of climate change patterns spread far beyond these mountains, which are the source of the Indus, Ganges, and Brahmaputra river systems that support the livelihood of some 129 million farmers across a region of nearly a billion people. The future will be marked by uncertainty, says water expert Himanshu Thakkar.
There are times when there is suddenly heavy rainfall or snowfall, and then there are other times when there is a much drier periods, longer drier periods. We don't know whether the higher rainfall will compensate the glacial melted, to what extent it will do. So it will depend. So these are a bit question mark. To what extent the water flow will reduce.
The anxiety over water flow has even fueled some resistance to the ice stupas. Sering Motup, leader in the village of Thay, got authorities to stop one greening project that would have been fed by a stupa, complaining that the water diversion would come at the expense of his community, which is further down the mountain.
These trees would grow big, taking the water in June and July, and our farms would be dry. It would have been very difficult for the villages below.
So whenever there is a diversion, there is resistance. But the only problem is that in this case, the diversion happens in winter when nobody uses water. But it will take some time for people to get used to the idea that it is only to keep it reserved for summer so they can get more.
And it's not just people here who must embrace new ideas, he adds.
The bigger solution is in the hands of people perhaps watching this show, whose lifestyle in big cities like New York or New Delhi is causing climate change. Our call should become an SOS call for the bigger world out there. It's because of their activities that we suffer for no fault of ours.
He invokes a plea once used by Mahatma Gandhi. Live simply, Wangchuk says, so we may simply live. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Ladakh, India.
And you heard it, an SOS call to all of us right here. Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.